Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You find his work at Fangraphs, where he is the senior editor. He is on Twitter at @based_ball, and he is a regular on the Bernstein and McKnight show, joining us at the All-Star break, where he has an opportunity to stretch out and continue to observe and write things as he has been doing. Jeff Sullivan, hello.
Hello. Opportunity to do exactly what I do every week, huh?
Every time you want to do anything like this, you know, this kind of appearance, you let us know. We'll have you on, I don't know, Tuesday, 10 o'clock, something like that.
That sounds great. I went to bed, and what was it, the Phillies were going to get Manny Machado. I wake up, and now it's the Dodgers who are the favorites for Manny Machado. I have no idea what changed, but yeah. I guess, I don't know. You want to talk about Manny Machado?
Yeah, well, don't worry. The only thing standing in between the Orioles and a Manny Machado trade are the medicals for the Orioles, so everything should be fine there. You wrote up a piece, Jeff, last week, I think it was, end of last week, about the precedents for a Manny Machado trade, and some good ones too, a rental specifically. And then I'm looking around, and I know a guy that you've worked with before, Michael Bauman on The Ringer, had another one about how teams shouldn't regret dealing for a rental in the same way. Before we get into the precedents and before we get into the player itself, are we at a point in baseball where teams who are pushing for a playoff spot like this are in a better place to understand what trading for a rental actually is, what the cost really should be?
Yeah, I think we are. I think this is something that's happened over the past, I don't know, 5, maybe even 10 years. But I think that when you start looking at older trades, you go back 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and what players got traded for back then means less to me now, because I think that there was an element of maybe of front offices getting emotional or overstating the impact that one player can really have on a baseball team. But you look at it now, and of course I know that wins above replacements or war is far from a perfect statistic, but it lays out an argument for why, if you get someone like, I don't know, Yu Darvish last year or Manny Machado this year, you're looking at probably a difference of 2 or 3 wins over the rest of the season. And of course you have them for the playoffs, but then how much are you really going to value that small number of wins over a few months if you're talking about trading for a good player, some high-level prospects who could make a difference as soon as next year and be around for more than half a decade? So I think the counter-argument to this is that we are sort of at a point where there is high degree of quote-unquote prospect hugging. Teams do get a little overprotective of the prospects they have, but there's a good reason for that, and it's because nothing is more valuable than a young player who's ready for the major leagues.
You know, we had a question yesterday from a Cubs fan who was asking about the performance of David Bote. And he was never considered a prospect. He's lately a guy who's 25, who's having a really good year and isn't a full-time major leaguer. Is there a history for anybody? Are there examples of non-prospects who became prospects enough to be a desirable asset? I mean, I know in the case of Bote, if he's going to be a corner infielder, he's got to have more than the one home run that he hit. It's got to be a power position. But I want to say his OPS is like .867. Good exit velo, some noticeable plays in the field. Are there histories for guys who teams just kind of luck into some value that they're able to flip for something that matters in a pennant race?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's a lot easier on the pitching side when you never know when maybe a new pitch or a new mechanical delivery can just make all the difference. But I mean, of course, the most obvious example here is just look at Corey Kluber, who is a non-prospect, came over in, what was it, the Ryan Ludwig trade or something. He was just the AAA nobody with the Indians, learned a sinker, refined his mechanics, picked up some other stuff, and he's one of the best pitchers in the world. Or you can even stay with the Indians, and on the hitting side, you have Jose Ramirez, who's one of, I don't know, the 5-10 best players in baseball right now, and he was not a prospect coming up through the system. Jose Altuve was not considered a very good prospect coming up through the system. Justin Turner wasn't a very good prospect, etc. Depends. Sometimes you have guys who just don't have a standout tool when they're in the minors. Other times, if you have someone like Justin Turner, it requires like a mechanical overhaul. But if you think about the overhaul, for example, Josh Donaldson became what the most valuable player, and he was pretty much a non-prospect prospect when he was in the minors. So David Bode, to my knowledge, he's not a dramatic swing overhaul guy. You might know that better than me, but he's just a guy who's hit steadily in the minors. And he doesn't, I don't know very much about his defense, but at least as a hitter, there's not a lot that he doesn't do pretty well. He has a track record of hitting for some power, and it picked up last year, and it's picked up some more this year. And I think that he has the hardest thing to evaluate, probably, when you're just looking at a guy in the minors, maybe you're scouting him for a few days in a row, is what his approach is at the plate, because you just can't learn that much about watching a guy for a weekend or a full series. But Bode has a pretty good eye, and he has pretty good power. And when you actually evaluate him, he's obviously not anywhere close to Chris Bryant, but if you have a guy who knows what pitches to swing at and he can hit some of them really hard, you probably have something like a league average player, which for a Cubs system that has needed someone to emerge, there's something to cling to here. He's kind of a real prospect.
So, Jeff, looking back to some of the things that Rob Manfred said over the All-Star break about all these organizations using analytics to their own benefit, and sometimes that's not for the good of the game. Sometimes that might help an individual franchise, but not the game on the whole. I think he might be onto something in regards to the trade deadline. I don't know if he meant it in this way, so I'll just kind of take his meaning out of context, which I'm sure everybody appreciates. There's this sense that you mentioned prospect hoarding, right? And this idea that, you know, whether it's Cubs fans regretting the fact that Gleyber Torres moved to the Yankees and the career that he's likely to have, we missed some of the fun of this. Like, there was a Title I. Ethics aside, in the Aroldis Chapman deal, there was a Title I because you had that guy. And I wonder if, you know, because of some of the valuations of prospects and the money-saving aspects of holding on to these little guys, that you wonder if you think that we're kind of missing the point of going after it to a certain degree. I think about the Brewers most when I'm talking about this side.
Yeah, I agree with you. And maybe if you want to have a player manifestation of this, I don't know if you saw, there was on The Athletic yesterday, there was an anonymous quiz of like 240-plus baseball players. Don't know if you saw that, but
we're getting to it.
We have it keyed up for a little later in the show. No spoilers, Jeff.
Saving it for a full segment.
All right. I'm not going to give it away. So let's change the talking point then. Never mind. You'll get there. So, yeah, I do think that when you have this wave of analytics and trying to optimize everything, you do sort of lose some of that. The carefree isn't the word, but just like reckless behavior that is a lot of fun to watch as an outsider. It's exciting. You have someone who's just like recklessly stealing bases or swinging at everything. Or if you have a team who's just like, yeah, you know what? We think this player can put us over the top. Let's trade our top three prospects to go get this guy. You know, you have an old trade like when the Expos traded for Bartolo Colon. They gave up a whole bunch of future, like 20 years of future value in order to get him for an ill-fated season. It's definitely fun, and I think that this sort of gets to the fundamental disagreement between your standard baseball observer and your analytical baseball observer, which is, from the analytical standpoint, what you're looking for is you're just trying to maximize your wins now and in the future. And that comes down to the argument that nobody likes anything more than winning as much as possible. Then the other standpoint is, well, this is just a game. It's entertaining. We want to be entertained. Whether or not you win or lose, it's something we still get to talk about. And honestly, how much of baseball can you really predict so many years out? Anyway, with Machado, I think the Phillies, I don't know if the Phillies are going to get Manny Machado, but according to the last rumors I saw, they don't want to give up Sixto Sanchez when they're a top pitching prospect to get him, which I get. He's a really good pitching prospect, but he's a pitching prospect. He's in Double-A. His numbers are good. They're not great. Of course, he has a really good arm, but, I mean, he is a pitching prospect. I would not hesitate to give up any number of pitching prospects for Manny Machado, not because I think Machado is going to make an enormous difference on the team down the stretch, but because it's a pitching prospect and you just can't really feel that comfortable about what they're going to do. So I do think we're losing a little bit of the fun. I think because of the amount of coverage and analytical coverage, maybe we're getting too much of that side of things. Maybe our perspective is skewed, but something just, when you don't have the reckless behavior in sports, it's something that you just have to look for, I guess, in another sport.
And you don't have the old school GMs acting on a whim. There's no whim anymore. You don't have the old steak dinner boom. You don't have the guy, you know, over a scotch clinking a glass and cutting a deal. And I guess that was kind of the fun of it. Some of the back room, you know, the big cigar smokers doing what they used to do. And you're right that everything now is so heavily analyzed, not from our end. I think it's easy for us to say, well, we're over. It's the actual people involved doing mm-hmm. such deep analysis that may be slowing the machinery a little bit, right?
And I think that part of this, there are still whim decisions. There are still sudden decisions. You can look at the Astros getting Verlander with a few seconds left on the waiver trade deadline clock last year, or the Dodgers getting Darvish at the last second, or there are other moves where GMs or presidents of baseball operations have made quick, maybe not quite impulsive decisions, but they have acted quickly. But a difference again, we could talk about the late Kevin Towers. You just have this older school of general managers who were just more accessible. They were more willing to talk about what they're doing. And now every single team, for a legitimate reason, I get it, but just about every single team is cloaked in secrecy. So nobody wants to say anything about what they're doing, what their methods are. Nobody's even going on background, to my knowledge, just talking to media people, talking about what this process is like, or giving that anecdote of, you know what, actually me and this agent were just drunk in a back room and then we worked out this free agent deal. I'm certain that hasn't stopped happening. I've been at the winter meetings. I know what people are drinking, but they just won't talk about it. And so when you have that as well, then there's really nothing that's providing the anecdotes from the other side, except for every so often you get a story of like, how did Theo Epstein sign John Lester?
Which is a fantastic story to read. Before we let you go, Jeff, the race in the NL Central has seemingly cooled some with the Brewers losing six in a row up to the break, and then the Cubs, you know, really surging with a series against San Diego. I had wondered, kind of out loud and a little bit to myself, if the Brewers go 3-3 in that stretch as opposed to 0-6, are they mentioned more often in Buster Olney's Twitter feed today about Manny Machado? Is that a team, in your mind, the Brewers, that have faded and faded for good? Or are there fixes to that roster that can be acquired here in the next handful of days that helps buoy them back up?
Yeah, I don't think they've faded for good. I think that they're still an excellent team. I know that just from day one, especially now, last I saw, Jimmy Nelson isn't expected back until September, if even at all. So they need rotation help no matter what, and that's been true from the beginning. But their bullpen is very deep. Their offense is pretty good. There are a number of players on the disabled list now. Machado would be a great help, but really, I think that when you have a team in the Brewers' position, which is not too different from the Braves and Phillies, where you have a rebuilding team that's still a little bit ahead of the schedule they set for themselves, they don't really want to trade for rentals. I think the Brewers are a team that would be really heavily in on Jacob deGrom, but I imagine the Mets would get cold feet if they haven't already. With regard to trading Jacob deGrom, I know that deGrom's agent had a statement yesterday that said if the Mets don't want to extend him, then they should trade him, and maybe that's trying to apply some pressure. So the Brewers are there, and you know, just as if they had won three more games, maybe their behavior would be different today. It can change really quickly also in the few days after the All-Star break. They still have another 2 weeks. I feel pretty strongly that the Brewers are going to make, let's call it, two moves between now and the deadline, and they have some obvious weaknesses to shore up. I don't think Machado is the kind of player that they would go as heavily after as someone like the Phillies or Dodgers, teams that could conceivably keep Machado after the season. I think that's part of the Phillies' perspective here, but I would not sleep on the Brewers. I know that they're trying to get better.
Jeff, thank you. We appreciate it as always.
Absolutely. I'll talk to you next week.
That is Jeff Sullivan, the senior editor of FanGraphs. I mentioned we had a lot of giveaways. We do.
We have a ton of stuff to give away today.
So you're not going to want to miss this. We have two pairs of passes to meet Joe Maddon following our July 24th live broadcast from the downtown Blue Cross Blue Shield studio. Also, three chances to win $1,000 via text. Did you see the back page of the Tribune today? Maybe you saw this in your Twitter feed.
Yeah,
or
I did, actually.
On their website. And this was put together by a guy named Will Larkin. That's a desk guy. It's not a name that I know. It says, "Stars are born here. An all-star team selected from only Chicagoland natives would be formidable."
Chicagoland. How wide is that net?
Would be formidable. I think it would. Formidable isn't the word that I would use.
Which word would you use?
I think it kind of sucks.
Okay.
I think if you start looking at what some other areas have produced and some this.
We talking 03 Tigers suck, or are we talking more like a 65 win team suck?
I'll let you be the judge, but this is not great. I kept hoping it would get better, and they've kind of fudged around the edges here. Somebody who's just born here and didn't grow up here, just the fact of being born here is all you need, and this team needs a little help. little help.
At the deadline, maybe you can pick somebody up here.
I think Chicago might need to trade for somebody. We'll get into that.
Look at Gary and see if you get Ron Kittle around.
But he'd help. They could use him. Yeah. Well, so we'll look at that in comparison to some other plays. You got the score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
All right, so this is your all Chicago area team. Chicagoland. Yeah. Chicagoland.
Let's put some respect on that name.
This is your starting lineup. So Chicagoland, we're talking about the metro area.
Yeah, all right.
Your starting lineup is Tom Haller at catcher, Phil Cavaretta at first, Marty McManus at second, Lou Boudreau at short, Freddie Lindstrom at third, Ricky Henderson in left.
Well, that's good.
Okay. Kirby Puckett in center.
Legit.
Jesse Barfield is your right fielder.
Oh.
And Ted Klazuski is your DH.
Okay, so I'm not, you know, blown away by the lineup. Maybe there's some decent starting pitching in here. Is there bullpen help at the back end? Are we gonna play good defense? We pitch well, play good D, and then squeak out a couple of 4-2 wins?
Yeah, your pitching staff, two guys who actually were on the same pitching staff are in Brett Saberhagen and Charlie Liebrandt.
Okay.
And then we're at Scott Sanderson, Bill Gullickson, Larry Gura, with Fritz Peterson, noted wife swapper, is the and Cy Falkenberg.
You could not be going
Cy
through
this. Cy Wyvenson!
You could not be going through this list with any more distaste.
Jim Clancy, Mark Mulder, Denny McClain.
Mark Mulder?
Yeah. Actually pitched against Joe Boers. They played against each other. Terry used to see him all the time.
Mark Mulder was fairly good.
Yeah. He was good for a little while.
Yeah.
Denny McClain, Johnny Rigney, Jim O'Toole, Carl Lundgren, and Dan Schatzeter. Oi.
Those are all major league ball players.
Oi.
They all played in the big leagues, Dan.
Yeah, I know, but this is your all, everything, you're all Chicago.
Your northern city is a thing here, right? I mean, the fact that you look through cities like Houston. Or anywhere in Florida.
Yeah, I started looking at like a Miami-Fort Lauderdale area, like the whole area kind of thing. Miami, your pitching staff, and this is first glance. I didn't do this scientifically, but I do know that the Miami-Fort Lauderdale pitching staff is going to have Steve Carlton and Randy Johnson coming at you first in one order or the other. And Alex Fernandez and Gio Gonzalez. And as far as the actual lineup for that team, you've got Andre Dawson, Manny Machado, Anthony Rizzo, Albert Almora. So, look at Las Vegas.
Oh, Las Vegas is, I mean, they've got three in the bigs now.
Well, Las Vegas, you've got
Gallows from Henderson. That's a suburb, right outside.
Suburb. It's a metro area. So you've got
it counts.
Bryant, Harper, Gallo, and Tommy Pham. And you already have Barry Zito as a pitcher on that team. Okay, so I know you're, and again, this is hard to do because I don't know the names of all the suburbs, but just Dallas, you already have.
Well, Dallas, you can take Fort Worth, too. I mean, that's essentially the same metro.
But Dallas, you got Clayton Kershaw, Ernie Banks, and Charlie Blackman just to sort of start things. And then you get to New York City. And this is just the boroughs, right? This is just Brooklyn, Manhattan, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island. So Your position players, in no particular order, Wee Willie Keeler, Phil Rizzuto, Lou Whitaker, A-Rod, Hank Greenberg, Lou Gehrig. Okay?
those are names.
And your pitching staff includes Jim Palmer, Whitey Ford, and Sandy Koufax. I think the Chicago team's in a little bit of trouble.
Nope, I don't know. We could expand the area some. A lot of textures trying to help out the ball club. Ron Coomer, we get Coom if we expand it to Lockport and just take Lockport.
That's all-star Ron Coomer.
That's all-star Ron
1999
Coomer.
1999 American League All-Star.
We get Curtis Granderson involved in the list.
But
if
Jason
you go out to Lansing, if you got the blue, Jason Kipnis from, he went to Glenbrook? North
somewhere,
I think, something like that.
Somewhere close.
Yeah, Kipnis is in here as a reserve.
Why?
On that bum-ass team? Yes.
The Indians started him in center field. You could put him damned anywhere.
Yeah, they had Granderson as a reserve.
Glenbrook North for Jason Kipnis.
Greg Luzinski, Cliff
He's on the
Floyd,
team for next year.
Dave Kingman. Okay.
But
Jeff Samardzija?
No, he's is he Indiana?
Yeah,
yeah, but it's the Chicagoland metro area.
Well, then we get Ron Kittle.
Hell yes.
Give me Ron Kittle.
Or give me death.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Looking forward to a conversation with Dan Orlovsky in just a little bit. We moved him up, but boy, the texters are going crazy and asking. I can't keep up with the speed of all this stuff, asking about other cities, saying, take a look at St. Louis, take a look at Santo Domingo. What is suggesting the Hampton Roads area, Norfolk, Virginia Beach, could be an underrated area?
I was looking through it. Philadelphia had a bunch of players. I mean, more just volume than anything else. But there were, for whatever reason, it was all guys who played from like 1890 to 1904.
They count. Look, if Willie really Keeler could be on the New York team,
they absolutely count. I just don't know how they're going to handle. Who do we have? Steve Traxel on the list somewhere, right? Some of that 90-mile-an-hour heat.
Yeah, I think once I start looking at some of these Puerto Rican cities, too, I mean, just if you look at just that island alone, if we look at all the guys from Bayamon or all the guys from Caguas or from Ponce, Rio Piedras, this gets pretty scary. Santurce, and I mean, just the names just will amaze you, because they're already, you're going to have multiple teams from Puerto Rico alone that are going to, it's like, do damage.
It's you know, Major League Soccer has gone through this a little bit. Sports specialization, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're screaming and yelling and about growing the sport and figure out who goes where and what plays, what athletes are playing which sport. And I know a lot of people have looked at America as, you know, there's too many options to actually filter the best athletes down to soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Are you dealing with the same issue then, you know, in these places? Because soccer's still a really big sport in some of those spots. But baseball is, I mean, that's, it's in the lifeblood. Because you're looking back through many, many years of this.
Right.
It's not just active players.
No. It's,
of course
it's,
not.
No, forever. That's, you know, and also the age of the actual city. New York is an old city. It's had more people born there.
That's the Philadelphia thing.
That's why the Las Vegas team is so ridiculous, because of how new that city sprung up in the desert. And when? The 40s? I mean, when
air conditioning came around. That's when it sprung up. Same as Houston.
Right. That's when these cities started, and all of a sudden, then you have baseball being the warm weather sport that it is. And there's so many, like, you probably could find a high school in Scottsdale that has produced more major leaguers than some of these cities.
Wasn't it A.J. Pierzynski and Johnny Damon played on the same high school team? Or if it wasn't the same high school, it was the same Legion team?
Winterhaven?
Sounds right.
Is it Winterhaven, Florida? I could be wrong. I know it's Florida somewhere, because I remember Johnny from the minors. And remember when he was a prospect of the year in the Midwest League.
It says Dr. Phillips High School.
Doc Phillips High School.
Doc Phillips High School in Orlando, I guess.
Yeah. Look at the
AJ and Johnny Damon.
I'm sure an all Orlando team just alone in some of these areas. But I guess you could, if you look on the bright side, you could say that for the baseball season, as far as the climate goes, for what Chicago, this is a lot of these guys came up before we had these year round baseball academies all through the suburbs for all of us travel baseball parents that spend way too much money on our children who will never be major league players. What a racket!
It really
what
is.
What a racket!
You need the equipment. Wow. You got to have the bats. You got to have the bat licensure thing, right? You make sure you have specific. What is the minus three?
Drop.
You got to have specific drop bats.
Drop. Yeah, it's
so far away from those numbers anymore.
Difference between the length and the weight, and then that's right. I guess for fall, I got to go buy a BB core. How much are those? A lot, right?
Probably $200
minimum.
Probably
right?
$200.
Shep put a tweet out of the old Black Magic bat.
That's what I use.
When they didn't care about the difference as much, so it was like it had a bigger barrel, and it was like a minus six. I beat the crap out of the ball.
I love the Easton Black Magic.
Oh hell yeah!
I had a different Easton, and then a teammate had the Black Magic, and I used it and for one at bat, and I just said, I am never using anything other than this bat ever, and if you can't come to the game, I'm going to your house and I'm getting this bat before the game.
I can get you a Black Magic. Looks like from about 1988, something like that, for about $17 on eBay.
Wow.
I don't get you one right now.
I don't think I really need it now.
You anyway, don't need one, but the boy needs one.
He's not going to use that. He'd take one look at it and go, this is totally lame. Give me a real bat.
It's like a Saved by the Bell episode right there on the barrel of the bat.
Dan Orlovsky is going to talk football with us. Get used to him because he's going to be a part of this show. We're going to talk about Mitchell Trubisky, talk about the start of training camp, and what we have to look forward to for the Bears NFL. It's Dan Orlovsky next on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Oh, well, we had to get that out of the way. He's never heard that highlight.
No, absolutely not.
No one's ever played it for him. No one has ever brought it up for Dan Orlovsky, the former NFL quarterback. This segment brought to you by Orkin. Ask Sherwin-Williams and save 40% on paints and stains during the four-day super sale, July 20th through the 23rd. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Dan Orlovsky is on Twitter, at Dan Orlovsky. He of the Backup Plan podcast, and he's part of our plans. Really looking forward to some regular hits with him during football season. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing much better after hearing that highlight, so I appreciate it.
Oh, because no one's ever played it for you before. No, it never comes up in casual conversation, ever.
It's a daily occurrence for me nowadays, so I always appreciate the different ways people utilize it as a gif or something to make fun of me or whatnot. So it's taken on a life of its own.
Well, thankfully, we're going to have you on as a regular guest during our football season. So we'll build a better library, and we won't have to go back into the vault every single time. When you look around camp starting up this week, Dan, and look around some of the rookie quarterback situations, some who have signed, some who haven't signed, does anybody compare to you to Mitchell Trubisky, who's going to be stepping into a brand new system? I almost look at this, and you and I talked about this the last time we had you on, about the difference between what you take if you're Mitchell Trubisky out of last year versus what you got to throw away and rebuild from. Anybody remind you of a situation that Mitchell's going to be in, a system like that that's going to fit those skills the way everybody hopes it'll fit?
Well, I think I would imagine that Baker Mayfield is a guy that hits my brain because, you know, one of the calling cards of Trubisky was really hard worker, a great kid as far as a football guy, and then kind of a unique athlete. And so I think Baker's, you know, lends to have some of those similarities. I think he's going to be in a much healthier situation, just talent around him than Trubisky was last year. You know, obviously it's been well documented the kind of the lack of weapons around Mitchell last year. I think Mayfield will have much more talent around him, probably a little bit better support system, full 1 through 53 guys on their roster. But that transition for any rookie quarterback is going to be incredibly difficult. And I think that, you know, the more positives you can take from a rookie season, really for Monday through Sundays rather than just the games, will be better off for all kids coming into the NFL.
We've talked so much about the offense, and we're not really going to know it until we start to see it a little bit. And through with the extra exhibition games, there's five exhibition games. I don't imagine that we're going to see much of what they're doing in these games, that they're just going to kind of line up and try to run some stuff and get a little bit of work in. But if somebody's going to camp and watching drills or trying to get a read on Trubisky and some of what they're trying to install, what would you look for? How would you watch a Bears practice upcoming to get some insight into what they're doing?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would do is, and I've spoken a lot about this, is seeing what they're doing pre-snap information-wise for him, utilizing a Trey Burton to gather man or zone, just putting him in different spots. I really do think he's the key to everything that they're going to do moving forward. So, okay, how are they utilizing Burton and Adam Sheehan, you know, in different areas, okay? So, you know, utilizing those guys, how are they moving them around? My second thing is, are they playing with any tempo? You know, I think that that's going to be a big part of what they do, and I don't think it's going to be this, you know, all the time, full speed, nonstop, no huddle tempo. I think I would look, are they changing their tempos, meaning do they have the ability to huddle? And then do they have the ability to play on the line of scrimmage fast? And do they have the ability to play on the line of scrimmage and maybe, you know, figure out what the defense is doing and calling some stuff at the line? I'd want to see, because I think a guy that's not getting talked about enough is going to be Helfrich for them offensively. And I think Helfrich is one of his strengths is understanding tempo and how to play with it. They did a couple different ways when he was at Oregon, so I would pay attention to that. And then just, what's the rapport with the guys that they've brought in? How is he thrown with Allen Robinson or Gabriel or, you know, like I've mentioned, Trey Burton, and just seeing how that connection is going. And then what are they doing in the variance of passing game? So, okay, are they hitting the different levels? Is the ball getting out of Trubisky's hands quickly? And then are they doing some stuff to hit the intermediate stuff? And then what are their shots looking like? Are their shots going to be majority just drop back stuff? Or are we going to do hardball play actions? Is it going to be movement stuff? Those would be like the four families that I would be paying attention to.
Outside of the actual football, outside of watching X's and O's, how does the rubber meet the road in Trubisky's relationship with his teammates? He's not a rookie now. And not only is he not a rookie, everything's bet on him. All of these coaching hires, the revamped offense, all of the – everything is done. And we talked to him about this a couple weeks ago. You know, no pressure. But if he's good, everything's fine. And if he's bad, everybody's fired. He's one of the most important Chicago professional athletes in a long, long time. How does he need to conduct himself? And what needs to happen throughout training camp to strengthen some of these bonds, to solidify him as a trusted leader beyond just where he's putting the football?
So I think he's well on his way to doing the easy part of that. And the easy part is his work ethic and how he goes and handles himself respectfully and punching the time in and studying and understanding the playbook and commanding the huddle and doing the extra stuff at practice and being a good teammate and, you know, taking the criticism. I think he's doing the easy part of that because that is the easy part of it. The hard part, and this is the reality of the NFL, is, you know, the leadership in the NFL is not what leadership is kind of in the everyday life or maybe in a lot of other people's jobs, because it's in the NFL, you have 16 opportunities to lead. Leadership really comes down to what you do on Sundays. And if you perform, then you're viewed as a leader. If you underperform, no one cares what you do during the week, all those little things, those easy things, because at the end of the day, and we say this all the time, it's a production-based business. So he's doing the right things with the easy stuff. But the production and the play and the success will have to come for him to truly take ownership of the city, to take ownership of the Chicago Bears. He's going to have everything fall in line with the vision that they've had as an organization. You know, with all these hirings and all these signings, there's this vision. Well, he's got to be the guy that's going to have to paint it on the canvas. And as long as he gets that done, he'll be the leader and he'll be the impactful guy that they're hoping for. But all those other things you need to do to give yourself that opportunity. So as long as he continues to do that, he's going to give himself the chance. And then at the end of the day, like we've talked, he needs to have that, you know, that Jared Goff type jump that so many people have referenced.
Talking with football expert and former NFL quarterback Dan Orlovsky on the Bernstein and McKnight Show on The Score, where it's time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash. This hour's keyword is advice. So text advice to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is advice to 72881. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please do not text and drive. Message and data rates may apply.
Dan, I want to go back to something you mentioned about the tempo, the pace of an offense, because we had Rich Campbell, who covers the Bears for the Tribune, in last week, and we talked a lot about that idea of Mark Helfrich and his tempo and what Oregon looked like the last handful of years and what this offense under Matt Nagy could look like. Is it fair to say that if Mitchell starts playing with tempo, that offense starts moving a little bit, that the playbook is going to get pared back just a bit, that because they're moving at speed, he might not be using everything? Or is it a situation where they don't start moving to that tempo unless he's got everything? Because I wonder if moving a little bit faster might be better for him because he's thinking less, the playbook's smaller, and you have that advantage against whatever defense is out there because you're the one pushing the action.
There's a fine balance to being able to do both. You know, you want to, because the reality is between the 20s, between the red zone, the 20 to the other 20, a lot of plays in football are relatively similar. And there's at the end of the day, there's 11 on 11. You can't, you know, you're not drawing stuff up and using 13 guys. So a lot of football is very similar. So playing with tempo in those places, I really think benefits a quarterback because it allows you to be on the offensive. You control what the defense can do to you more often than not. Now, defenses handle it better nowadays because they're more equipped. But like you mentioned, quarterbacks think a little bit less. Their reads are a little bit more defined. They play in a little bit of rhythm. But you want to be able to do that and also have that playbook expanded in those third down situations or those red zone situations when the matchups become a bigger deal and the formational things that you can do become a bigger deal. And so I'd imagine what they do, this is what good coaches do, and from what I know of Nagy and a little bit of Helfrich, you know, you take a package and you implement it into some form of a tempo, whether it's four plays, six plays, eight plays, you implement it into your tempo package. Hey, fellas, this is going to be our fastball package. We are going to go to the line of scrimmage as quick as we can, and we'll communicate it with whatever, a single word or a single number. And once those guys get it, and they're from your original playbook, you take those plays from the original install that you have and put that as a package. And then once you feel like your guys have a good feel for that and are running it efficiently, then you take another package and take another six or eight plays. And you say, okay, that guys, this is going to be our speedball package where we're just going to get to the line of scrimmage, but we're not going to snap it as quick as we can. And then once those guys control that, then you can continue to add pieces here and there. And then so you basically build you install your playbook, and then you just take a piece here, a piece there, and rebuild your playbook just using it as in a different tempo form. And I think that's something that will really, because again, Helfrich is renowned for tempo, but using it in different ways. It's not, you know, what people know as Chip Kelly balls to the wall as fast as we can. It's changing. It's that different pace. That's what Sean McVay does so well in L.A., and that's, you know, I reference him to Greg Maddux. It wasn't this overpowering thing. You just never knew when it was going to come. Hmm. And so you can imagine for a defense, oh, you know, if the offense gets the line of scrimmage fast, it snaps the ball super fast, and then they do it again the next play, but they're, you know, they hold off and just gain some information. That's when you're really going as an offense and dictating to a defense what's going to happen. Now, you need to have the people to do that, and I think the Bears do, but that's where the tempo for me is going to be so big for Mitchell moving forward. And you don't need 45 plays for that. All you need is 15, 20 plays that you're really good at to go in between the 20s. And then when you get down in the red zone, that's when you start getting those game plan specific things in place, maybe huddling a little bit more.
See, that's fascinating. And to me, what's going to be critical to watch in a first-year head coach and a developing second-year prospect at quarterback is – When less is more, when less coaching is more. I know there's going to be a desire by Nagy to control and to always coach. But if Trubisky's good, if he really is starting to become himself, then it's going to be Nagy understanding when to give him the ownership and when to give him a little bit more control. I don't know when that's going to be, when some of those inflection points in a season might occur, but I guess will we know it when we see it?
Yeah, certainly. I think that you always want to have that balance of coach to player, and you always want the coach to understand players over plays. Players over plays are more important, and then understanding what those guys do well. That's why, you know, a guy like Chase Daniel is such a big deal and is so important and worth the X amount of dollars that you invest in him, because he's been in those situations, whether as a backup or as a player, and can communicate. He can be that in-between guy, that bridge guy that, you know, can speak to Nagy as a respected player and also speak to Mitchell as a somewhat of a coachy mentor type role, and to really allow that relationship to continue to grow, where as a coach, Nagy's going to be a little bit more willing to allow you to have a little bit more rope once you start performing at a high level, and then Mitchell having a little bit more confidence to go, hey, coach, I don't like this. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, coach, can we do more of this? Or, coach, I can we start the game in this way? So that's why that guy, Chase Daniel, is such a big deal and well-respected and worth one of those 53 roster spots. But really, you'll see it when you're going to start seeing some stuff where Mitchell at the line of scrimmage and being in control, that's when you're going to see Nagy go, okay, I trust him. Now, don't expect that in the first 6, 7, 8 weeks of the season. That's something that you earn, you know, over a long period of time. But I think that those guys will have a really healthy relationship of communicating, and Chase will be a big part of it.
That's great stuff from Dan Orlovsky, who is going to be part of the Bernstein and McKnight Show weekly, breaking down the Bears, Mitchell Trubisky, and the NFL. We really appreciate it and really excited about this season and looking forward to your continued contributions.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys having me. Trust me, I'm as excited as anybody to watch the Bears. I'm not a Bears fan, but I'm excited to watch what they're going to be able to do. So I'd be excited to be a part of it with you guys.
All right, looking forward to more of it. Dan Orlovsky, that's stuff you don't get from other sources.
No, that tempo stuff is fantastic.
Like he said, Greg Maddux, it's about upsetting timing. It's not necessarily racing by you. It's just about upsetting your timing.
He mentioned it too, but it's about taking advantage of the sub packages that come in on defense. So those defensive linemen that maybe in or out are not in the ideal situation and going, that's it, now we go, because we can keep them on the field.
This segment brought to you by Dell. Dell small business technology advisors know there's nothing small about your business. They provide one-on-one partnership and reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors. Call 877-BUY-DELL. The Midway is next. We have a little development in the baseball world that is breaking as we speak. I want to get to that. We also have more activity. The volcano is on the attack.
No,
it's not just building islands now. Now it's we've got another thing.
It's expanded its territory and now being more aggressive.
Right, it's like Risk. It's moving.
It's going for Kamchatka,
and now it is. It's going to Irkutsk and then Yakutsk and other various Kutsks too. What do you have?
We've got a little bit of a college football kerfuffle. More coaches being just coachy, McCoach face. Also, I'm going to make an appeal. I'm going to make an appeal to the I'm Fat podcast. Last night, I tried to make an entry into the I'm Fat realm, and I know I'm never going to get there. I understand that this is a pipe dream, a very skinny pipe of mine, but that it's something that I'm aspiring to, and I'm making an appeal.
So many poorly chosen words.
Yeah, well, Tobias, tell you what you do. Get yourself a tape recorder, and you follow yourself around.
That's coming up. Midday Midway. We hit it next on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.